As she served dinner that evening, Udra abruptly sent Nicholas on an errand that got him out of the hut for a few minutes. Then, as she spooned thick fish soup into Isabella's bowl, she leant so close to her that a loose strand of her hair brushed Isabella's cheek.
"Do not speak or look at me," she whispered. "I have a message from the Marquez."
Isabella dropped her spoon with a clatter.
"Careful, give no sign. He says that he will try to come to you, but it is difficult and dangerous. He say that he love you. He say to be brave."
All thought of suicide was driven from her mind. Ramon was close. Ramon loved her. She knew deep down in her heart that it would be all right as long as she had the fortitude to brave it through, and Ramon's help. The knowledge kept her going through the next 2 days. There was a new sparkle and zest in her that she was able to share with Nicholas. The restlessness and creeping ennui which had begun to affect their relationship evaporated. They were happy again together. In the nights she lay awake in her hut, no longer devoured by doubt and brooding fears, but waiting for Ramon.
"He will come. I know he will."
Then one of the women who had met her and searched her luggage on arrival came to her, but with a message.
"There is an aircraft departing at 9 o'clock tomorrow. You will leave with it."
"The child?"
she demanded.
"Nicholas Pele?"
The woman shook her head.
"The child remains. Your visit is terminated. They will fetch you at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. You must be ready. Those are my orders."
She wanted to take some memento of her son with her. After she had showered and changed for dinner, she took a pair of nail scissors from her toilet bag and hid them in the pocket of her Bermudas. When Nicholas was seated at the dinner table, she came up behind him, and before he could pull away, she snipped a thick, dark curl from the back of his head.
"Hey," he protested half-heartedly, "why do you do that?"
"I want something to remember you by when I'm gone."
He thought about that for a while and then asked shyly,
"Can I have some of your hair as well to remember you?"
Without a word, she handed him the scissors. He stood in front of her and streamed one of her tresses between his fingers.
"Not too much," she warned him.
He laughed and cut a lock and curled it round his finger.
"Your hair is soft and pretty," he whispered.
"Do you really have to go, Mama?"
"I'm afraid so, Nicky."
"Will you come and visit me again?"
"Yes, I will. I promise you that."
"I will keep this piece of your hair in my jock book."
He fetched the book and pressed the curl between the pages.
"Every time I read the book, I will think of you."
The moon was almost full. The silver radiance sifted in through the open sides of her hut and cast stark shadows that moved softly across the floor to mark the passage of the hours.
"He must come,"
she told herself, lying rigid with fearful hope on the hard mattress.
"Please let him come."
Suddenly she sat bolt upright. She had heard nothing, seen nothing, but she knew with utter certainty that he was close. She had to force herself not to call his name aloud. She waited with every sense alert, and then suddenly, without sound, he was there. He appeared like a wraith in the silver moonlight, and she gagged the cry that rose in her throat. She threw back the mosquito net, and with three quick steps had crossed the hut and was in his arms. Their kiss seemed to last a moment, and all of infinity. And then, still without a word, he drew her down the front steps of the hut and into the sanctuary of the palm grove.
"We do not have long,"
he warned her softly, and she choked back a sob and clung to him.
"What is happening to us, darling?" she pleaded. "I don't understand any of it. Why are you doing this to us?"
"For the same reason that you are forced to obey, for Nicholas and for you."
"I don't understand. I cannot go on, Ramon. I have reached the end of my strength."
"Not much longer, my darling, I promise you that. Soon it will be over, and we will be together."
"You said that last time, darling. I've done all I can."
"I know, Bella. What you have done has saved us, both of us, Nicholas and me. Without you, we would have long since been destroyed. You have bought time and life for us."
"They have made me do terrible things, Ramon. They have made me betray my family and my country."
"They are pleased with you, Bella. This visit is proof of that. They have given you 2 weeks with Nicholas. If only you can last a little longer, give them just a little bit more of what they want. They will never let me go, Ramon, I know that. They will hold me forever and bleed the last drop. Bella, darling. He stroked her body through the thin silk of her nightgown. I have a plan. If you can keep them happy just a little longer, next time they will be more lenient. They will trust you a little more. They will start to become careless. And then, I promise, I will bring Nicky to you. Who are they? She whispered. But he was beginning to make love to her, and the question faltered. Quiet, my love, don't ask. It is best you don't know. At first I thought it was the Russians, but the Americans acted on my skylight message. The Americans used my information and the Angola raid. Is it the American CIA, Ramon? You may be right, my love, but for Nicky's sake, don't provoke them. Oh, God, Ramon, I'm so unhappy. I didn't believe that any civilized people could treat others in this way. Not much longer, he whispered. Be strong. Give them what they want for just a little longer, and then Nicky and I will be with you. Make love to me, Ramon. It's the only thing in the world that can keep me from going mad.
Nicholas drove her to the airstrip the following morning. He was tremendously proud of his driving skill, and she was effusive in her praise. José and the regular driver were in the back of the jeep, and she overheard a remark that one made to the other, that at the time made little sense, but stuck in her memory like a burr. Pele is the true cub of the fox El Zorro. At the ramp of the Aleutian, they said goodbye to each other.
You promised to come and see me again, Mama, Nicholas reminded her. Of course, Nicky. What present should I bring you?
My soccer ball is worn and leaking. We have to pump it many times during the match.
I will bring you another one. Thank you, Mama.
He offered her his hand, but she could not restrain herself. She dropped to her knees and hugged him to her breast. For a shocked moment he stood very still in her arms, and then he tore himself violently from her embrace. His face was scarlet with humiliation. He glared at her, then whirled and ran for the jeep. She peered down from the small side window in the flight deck of the Aleutian, but Nicholas was gone. She saw the fine pall of dust still hanging over the road to the beach. He left a great emptiness in her soul. She disembarked from the Aleutian in Libya, where it landed to refuel, and caught a Swissair flight to Zurich. She airmailed postcards to everybody in the family, including Nanny, and used her credit cards to establish her presence in Switzerland. She even called on Schaas's bankers in Lausanne to withdraw 10,000 francs and thus allay any suspicions that her father might have about her holiday. The photographs she had taken of Nicholas were beautiful. She had captured his typical expressions and moods and characteristic poses. Even those of him in his camouflage fatigues, handling that dreadful assault rifle, gave her more pleasure than distress. She was keeping a journal for Nicholas. It was a thick-bound book with pockets inside the covers, and it contained every memento of Nicholas that she had accumulated over the years. There was a copy of his official Spanish birth certificate and adoption papers. She had hired a London firm who specialized in this type of work to trace the Machado family back 3 centuries. A copy of the family tree and the Machado heraldic arms were in the front pockets of the journal. There was also the baby booty that she had retrieved from under his cot in the flat in Malaga. She had pasted in the copies of the reports from his nursery school and the pediatric clinic, together with every photograph they had ever sent her. She wrote her own comments and a description of her feelings of love and hope and despair on alternate pages. When she returned to Feldefrieden, she added the lock of his hair and the photographs she had taken of him to her hoard, and included a description of their interlude together. She even recorded their conversations and every amusing or poignant comment he had made. When she felt deeply depressed and unhappy, she locked herself in her suite, retrieved the journal from her personal safe, and gloated over every item in it. It gave her the strength to go on. The beach craft banked into a steep descending turn, and the release of gravity made Isabella felt light in the near seat. "There," Gary shouted from the pilot's left front seat. See them? At the foot of the hill. Three of them. Isabella stared down at the forest top and the broken ground along the rim of the escarpment. The rock was fractured into battlements and turrets, wild cliffs and tumbled towers like the ruins of some fabulous fairy castle. The forest filled the valleys and the ravines between the rocky castles with splendid chaos. Great tree trunks towered up 100 feet or more, with widespread branches clothed in autumn livery, gilded with all the amalgams of gold and copper and bronze. Other great trees were already bare of leaf. The bloated baobabs with the reptilian bark squatted grotesquely as creatures from the age of the dinosaurs. At the very wingtip of the beechcraft, a giant African ebony flashed by, its leaves still dark shining green and its top branches studded with ripe yellow fruit. A flock of green pigeons hurled themselves in wild alarm into the air and darted by so close that she could see their bright yellow beaks and the beady shine of their eyes. Then, abruptly, the forest ended, and a glade of pale winter grass stretched below them. The beechcraft roared straight at the tall cliff of rock on the far side. "There, can you see them, Bella?" Gary called again. "Yes, yes, aren't they magnificent?" she shouted back. At the far end of the clearing, three bull elephants ran in single file. Their ears were spread wide as the lateen sail on an Arab dhow. Their backs were humped so that she could see the curved and crested ridge of the spine beneath the grey hide and the gleam of long curved ivory carried high. As they flashed 20 feet over him, the lead bull turned to confront them. He reached up with a long serpentine trunk as though to pluck them from the sky. Then Gary pulled back on the control column. Gravity sucked at Isabella's bowels, and the aircraft hurtled up to skim the raw blue granite and then bore up high into the cloudless African sky. "That big one would go all of 70 pounds," Gary was judging the weight of the bull's tusks as he twisted in the seat, looking back over his shoulder, flying by instinct alone even in this critical angle of climb. "Are they in our area, Pater?" he asked as he rotated the nose down and eased back on throttle and pitch to resume level flight. "On the edge of it." Sharza was relaxed in the right-hand seat beside him. He had taught Gary to fly and knew his capabilities. "That's the national park over there. You can see the cut line through the forest that marks the boundary." "Well, those old Jumbo are heading straight for it." Isabella leant on the back of her father's seat, and he turned and grinned at her. "You bet your sweet life they are," he agreed.
"You mean they know which is hunting concession and which is the sanctuary?"
"Like you know your own way to your own bathroom. At the very first hint of trouble, they head for home and mother."
"Can you see the camp?" Gary asked.
"Yeah, just south of that koppie," Sharza pointed ahead through the windscreen. "There, now you can see the smoke there. The landing strip runs parallel to that patch of dark jesse bush."
Gary eased the power again, sinking back towards the wilderness, winging low over the rough bush strip to check that it was clear.